So now, if we want to, so let's again recall the lambda level spectrum. So let's impose Landau gauge, right? So again, Landau gauge as usual. So ax equals minus by, and ay equals zero. Then also let's measure the distance in the units of magnetic length and the momentum, right? So distance in units of L, momentum in units of H over L, such that we don't have to drag the dimensional factors all over the place. And once you do that and rescale your coordinates, you can write down the effective one-dimensional Hamiltonian, which would describe your dependence of your wave function on y, right? Because remember, so in the Landau gauge, you can pick the momentum in one direction and get the equation for the dependence of the wave function on the other coordinate. So the Hamiltonian would look like that. So this is the energy scale which we're going to define. Oh, thank you. Sure. So this is the energy scale which depends on magnetic field, and here we have the differential operators minus y. So here plus and minus correspond to the k and k prime points. This scale epsilon naught equals square root 2 h bar Fermi velocity divided by the magnetic length. So you can see it has dimension of energy, right? And via the dependence of the magnetic length on the magnetic field, it will also depend on the magnetic field, right? So it will scale with magnetic field. Finally, this capital Y, it's simply related to the x momentum. So this is the guiding center position. So our goal is to find the spectrum of this Hamiltonian. Fastest way to get there is to square it, right? So let's square it, and you're going to see that it's going to take a very simple form. So consider h kk prime squared. So what happens if we square this Hamiltonian? So for example, if we square hk, you'll see that, okay, you need to multiply this one by this one. So right, it's a minus epsilon naught squared over 2 minus 1. Here you get y squared minus y squared plus 1. Here, how did we get this? So when you multiply this guy by this guy, right, you see you would get a second derivative, right? You would get also square of this y minus y capital, and also you would get you can act with the derivative on this one. That's why you have this extra factor of minus 1. And you'll see, you know, these two operators do not commute, and that's why here you get plus 1 and not minus 1. And this is actually important. So but now you recognize that this Hamiltonian is quite simple, right? So I could write it like that. So actually there is a minus sign, must be minus sign here, like that. You can see that this guy is a simply harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian with a shift, and so is this one, but with an opposite shift, right? So now we of course know, right? We know the spectrum of the harmonic oscillator. So spectrum of this squared operator right? It can be h omega c, which is 1 in my case. So I'm just left with this epsilon naught squared as an overall prefactor. It would be n plus 1/2. Because I have this one here, I also need to add or subtract another one, another 1/2, right? So you see that my spectrum of the squared operator becomes epsilon naught squared times n, right? So it's a simple integer without a 1/2 shift. So, and now to find the spectrum of my original Hamiltonian, all I need to do is take a square root of this, right? So take square root and you'll get that Landau level energies in this case are simply given by epsilon naught square root n, and I can take either plus or minus sign here because I need to take a square root, right? And also you could see that there must be plus and minus sign from the particle Hall symmetry, right? So our band is particle Hall symmetric, and the way to actually way to see it is quite simple. You can see that there is an operator which anti-commutes with the Hamiltonian, right? So if you consider a simple sigma z, right, the third Pauli matrix, and commuted with the Hamiltonian, right, because the Hamiltonian is always has a form, it's some, you know, some operator 1 times sigma x, right, plus operator 2 sigma y, and sigma z always anti-commutes with sigma x and sigma y, right? So that's why this guy always gives you minus h, right? So this is the particle Hall symmetry. So this tells you that if you have implications that such an operator exists, is that if you have energy level, right, with wave function psi and energy epsilon, then sigma z acting on this eigenstate would be also eigenstate, right? But with the energy minus epsilon, right? So you can see it quite easily. So h acting on sigma z psi would be, so you can drag this guy to the left and exchange sign. It's minus sigma z h psi. This is minus epsilon, because this is eigenstate, sigma z psi, right? So by the definition, you got that this vector is an eigenstate with energy minus epsilon, right? So this is the particle Hall symmetry. We found the spectrum in valley k, right? In valley k, but the spectrum in the valley k prime would have the analogous form. So this tells us that if we are to plot the energies of the Landau levels, they will look like that. So first thing we notice is that we can put n to be zero, which tells you that there is a Landau level at exactly zero energy. And there are two of them because they have valid degeneracy. So two zero modes. And then they go like that. Then they go, so there is a level at epsilon naught, which is again doubly degenerate. Then next one would be epsilon naught square root 2, square root 3. And they have the same situation at negative energy, so I have minus epsilon naught square root 2, and so on. Right, so this spectrum is quite interesting. So it looks, in many ways, it's quite different from the usual spectrum of Landau levels. Right, so what are the important properties? So first property is that it's particle hole symmetric. Second, it's doubly degenerate, right? Because we have two valleys. Double degeneracy. So there's k and k prime valleys. Now, another very curious thing is that Landau level spacing is not constant, right? Not equally spaced as like that. So if I'm to take epsilon n plus 1 minus epsilon n, it will be epsilon naught square root n plus 1 minus square root n. So let me put them into the denominator, and I'll get something like that, such that if you send n to infinity, you'll see that they will get denser. So now let's use these properties to obtain the sequence of the quantized Hall plateaus, right? And you'll see that we'll get this half integer so-called quantum Hall effect. So in order to see that, we actually have all the ingredients. So let's recall that each Landau level gives a contribution to the Hall conductivity, which is simply given by the number of harmonic flavors in this, by the degeneracy of this Landau level, right? So let's say, what does it mean? That if I go from chemical potential mu 1 to chemical potential mu 2, right? My Hall conductivity must jump, in this case, by 2 times E squared over H, right? So because remember, this picture, if it's empty, generally, once chemical potential crosses one Landau level, Hall conductivity increases by E squared over H, right? So sigma xy, let me call it 2, minus sigma xy 1, must be equal to 2 E squared over H, right? Now, I also have particle Hall symmetry. So I know that here, this situation for electrons is analogous to this situation, but for Halls, right? And electrons and Halls have opposite charges, so they would have opposite Hall conductivity. So which gives you second condition that sigma xy 1 should be minus sigma xy 2. Right, and you can use these two equations to get the result that sigma xy1 is minus E squared over H, and sigma xy2 is plus E squared over H. Right, so this tells me that so I found the conductivity here. It's so now let me plot sigma xy next to it. So here it's minus E squared over H. Here it's plus E squared over H. Then if I fill the next Landau level, I need to add 2 again, right? So it will be 3 E squared over H, 5, and so on. And here it will be same thing but negative, minus 3 E squared over H. Right, so now if I use this result to plot the Hall conductivity per harmonic flavor, right? So let me go back to where I started and plot sigma xy divided by nf. So in this case, nf is simply 2 because I have two valleys as a function of density. I will get that, okay, so I have a plateau at 1/2, 3/2, and so on. Right, so there is this. There is this shift of 1/2. Okay. Now, intuitively, you could understand where it comes from. So, essentially, it's also a result of the Beres phase of the Dirac particles because the when you think about lambda levels, you could think about them in terms of quantizing quasi-classical orbits, right? And for usual non-relativistic electrons, you get the quantization condition, which gives you this extra 1/2, right? But now since electrons also pick up Beres phase, this 1/2 is cancelled by the Beres phase. So, and that's how you end up with this unusual sequence of Landau levels. Okay, so there is also another quite important difference from the usual case, which is how the Landau level spacing scale with the magnetic field. So remember, in this case, the cyclotron energy, right? So let's say difference between energies of the first one and zeroth one, right? So which is analog of cyclotron energy. It's proportional to epsilon naught. And remember, what is epsilon naught? So epsilon naught is square root 2 h v naught divided by L. Let's recall the definition of the magnetic length. So you see that it scales as a square root b rather than linearly in b. Since generally we are dealing with the magnetic fields which are not too strong on the lattice scale, right? This means that such small fields, this spacing would be much larger than the linear spacing in the usual semiconductor. So for example, if you were to just simply plug in the numbers, you would find that epsilon naught is really huge. So it's a 1,000 Kelvin at sort of usual for such experiments field of 10 Tesla. What does this imply? So this implies that the quantum Hall effect in Dirac material would be very robust, right? This is because think for a second how does the temperature destroy quantum Hall effect, right? So once temperature is high enough that you can thermally excite your carriers to the higher Landau levels, or you know they can borrow energy from the bus and stop being localized, right? That's when your system starts dissipating, and that's when the quantum Hall effect is gone. So the temperature, and at which this happens is very roughly is set by the spacing between Landau levels, right? So dies when temperature is of the order epsilon naught times some number of order one. Right? So for example, in the usual semiconductors, quantum Hall effect dies at something like 10 or 15 Kelvin, right? Because of this property, quantum Hall and graphene can be in fact observed at room temperature. Right? So this is so Dirac spectrum gives rise to room temperature quantum Hall effect, which is if you think about it, this is quite remarkable to get a pure quantum effect at room temperature. This is really not something you see often, right? So so in general, this half integer quantum Hall effect is a sort of indication that you have Dirac carriers in your system, right? And on some, you can also view it on some higher level as the result of some kind of anomaly of the Dirac fermions in 2D. So, but we won't go into that. So, now of course you may wonder, right? Yesterday we derived that the whole conductivity should be also e squared over h times an integer, and now I'm telling you, okay, it's half integer, right? But of course, there is no contradiction. We are still dealing with the integer quantum Hall effect. It is just that I plotted it I plotted the contribution of a single fermionic flavor to the Hall conductivity. That's why I got 1/2. Right. So from this, you could actually guess, right, that I cannot have a system with just a single Dirac fermion. Right. Because if I did, then okay, from this picture, I would end up with having half integer Hall conductivity, which is not possible because it's topological invariant, which must be integer. Right. So and this is sort of intuitive way to, you know, by combining our results from yesterday and from today to see the fermion doubling theorem, which tells you that if you consider the latest model, Dirac points would always come in pairs, right? You cannot come up with a tight binding model which would only have single Dirac fermion in the band structure, right? So is this argument in this part clear? So then let's start thinking about fractional quantum Hall effect. All right, so far we've been looking at the following picture. So we plot sigma xy as a function of number of field lambda levels, and okay, we obtain that sigma xy behaves like that, so it exhibits some steps, right, with plateaus at integers. But turns out that as you experimentally, it was found that once you increase the purity of your sample, then the picture becomes even richer. So first, as you make it a bit more pure, you find that there are plateaus developing at 1/3, 2/3, 4/3, so 4/3, 5/3. If you make it even more pure, you start seeing a lot of other plateaus, right? So you start seeing 5th, 7th, right, all kinds of stuff. So this picture looks very, very complicated. There is clearly a lot of stuff going on. And each plateau in sigma xy is accompanied by vanishing sigma xx, right? So all of these states are clearly insulating because there is no transpose to the bulk, right? So this is fractional quantum Hall effect because the Hall conductivity is quantized fractional quantization of sigma xy, right? And you can see right away that this is very much at odds with our quasi-classical percolation picture, because there, if we are sitting at filling factor 1/3, right, we are occupying only the localized states, and clearly they cannot give rise to finite sigma xy, right? So there is something very important that percolation picture is missing, and this important ingredient is electron interactions. So which really play very, very important play central role in forming this fractional quantum Hall states. So let's think about partially filled lambda level, right? And let's again, so let's start with the limit when there is no disorder, right? So we have lambda level. Right, so there are lots of degenerate states. Let's say I have n degenerate states which are given by the area of the system divided by the density, 2 pi L squared. And let me fill, you know, let me consider filling factor 1/3. 1/3. So I put n over 3 electrons into it. These electrons are interacting, right? And in principle, there are lots of dimensionality of the Hilbert space is really enormous, right? Because there are many ways in which I could fill these orbitals, right? There are this many possible states, right? So it's, which is really huge. Right, so dimensionality of the Hilbert space we are dealing with. Notice that this makes this problem very different from the, you know, from the familiar things like Fermi liquid. Why is that? Because for the Fermi liquid, you can essentially deal with the non-interacting quasi-particles, right? So you only need to worry about the effectively single particle spectrum, which is of course, right, which has dimensionality much less than this, right? So in this system, single particle spectrum is has only n levels, right? But if you have a lot of electrons, then you need to think about the full many-body space, right? And this space is really enormous. So this seemingly makes this problem completely intractable, right? Because on top of that, there is no kinetic energy to somehow separate energy scales, right? So everything is degenerate, and there are tons of states. So, but turns out that in some sense, it's probably a lucky accident. Turns out one can make quite a bit of progress. For that we will need to develop some formalism of how to describe electron interactions in the system. It will be more convenient for us now to work in the symmetric gauge, right? And the reason for that is clear. Before, we were mostly interested in the current and edge states, so there Landau gauge was more appropriate. But now we want to think about interactions, right? And if you think in the symmetric gauge, the conservation of the angular momentum becomes evident, right? So let's think about Landau levels in symmetric gauge. So symmetric gauge is quite simple. So we pick the gauge which looks like that. Okay, and then my Hamiltonian still has the same usual form. So I will again choose magnetic length to be 1, right? Not to worry about this dimensional factors. So our goal is essentially to understand the structure of the single particle states within the Landau level first, right? This is our first task. And turns out you can define the ladder operators which are in some way are very, very similar to the ladder operators in the harmonic oscillator, except now you have to define two kinds of the ladder operator. So first kind is going to take you between different Landau levels. So let me call it A, and A is defined like that, plus ipy. So where pi in this case is a pi pi x or y is simply pxy plus the vector potential. Right? So you can check, right, if you now also have also introduced the conjugate of this operator, you can check that they commuting, they give you one, and sure enough, you can write your Hamiltonian in terms of this A operator. So it will be simply 1/2 A dagger A plus A dagger. Right, so this effectively tells you that if you take some state and find the average of this operator A, it's gonna give you the Landau level number. Right, so this operator increases your Landau level number by one. So now it's also useful to write the representation of the ladder operators in terms of coordinates, and turns out that this problem has a lot of symmetries, and the symmetries become most obvious if you think in terms of complex coordinates. So let me introduce z, which is x plus iy, and from now on we are gonna deal with this complex coordinates. So then in terms of z, these operators can be represented in the following form, and that's again simple algebra, so we won't go into that. So it's z over 2 plus 2 d over d dz bar, and a dagger is square root 2 z bar over 2 minus 2 d dz. Now this is only half of our task. So our second task is to construct operators which would take us within a given Landau level, right? So effectively, you're looking for an operator which commutes with the Hamiltonian, right? Which commutes with the Hamiltonian such that applying it, you can, you know, having found one wave function, you can make another one and another one and another one and so on, and this way you would construct the whole Hilbert space. So, and it turns out if you play with these operators a bit, you would very quickly find that you can define another ladder operator B, which looks quite similar to A, but has the complex conjugation in the right places. So it looks like that, and its conjugate is z over 2 plus, so minus, right? Because when you conjugate derivative, you should take a minus sign, d over dz bar. So, and you can check, right? So let's check that these operators commute with A. So let's just check for one, for A and B commutator. So let's take A from there. So it's plus 2 d over dz bar. B is this. Z bar over 2 plus 2 d dz minus, now I just switch their places. Right, so so let's just look at it term by term. So this guy gives you z squared over 4. This one gives you z d dz. This one gives you d dz bar z bar, right? Plus 4 d2 dz dz bar. And this one will give you a very similar thing, except now you would have, so this guy, right? Minus z bar d dz bar minus d dz z minus 4 d2 dz dz bar, right? You see that, okay, these terms die, these terms die, and these terms, in these terms, you just need to commute it once, so it gives you extra factor of 1 plus 1, but then there is also this one that you have to commute, right? Where you have to commute derivative with z, and that's going to give you minus 1. So those factors will cancel, and you'll get 0. And you can check that very similarly that, you know, a b dagger is 0, and b dagger is 1. So it's again, it looks like a harmonic oscillator operator, right? So this tells you that if you have some state within Landau level, and then you apply this b dagger number of times, right, you would get a new state. So the Hilbert space within, let's say, 0th Landau level, 0th Landau level Hilbert space. So it looks like that. So I need to start with the wave function, right, which is at the bottom of the ladder, which is killed by both A and B, so which is the analog of the lowest state of the harmonic oscillator. So which would be simply this. So you can check easily that it's killed by both A and B. So A C naught is 0 and B C naught is 0. And this indices simply say that it's a lower state for both A and B. Now I can construct all the other states. So C0M should be simply B dagger or M square root M prime C0, 0. Right, so this is the M's orbital state within the 0th Landau level. And I can derive the explicit form of this states by simply using the definition of B, right? By just looking at how it acts on this exponential. So, for example, if I want to find C0, 1, okay, I just act on it with B. So it's z/(2 - 2) d z bar times 1/√(2π) e^-z(z)/4. Right, so okay, so this one I just multiply, and this one I have to take a derivative, right, so which would give me another z/(2). So it gives you 1/√(2) z/(2) + z/(2) would give me z, and I have 1/√(2π e^-z(z)/4. Right, and then you can easily see that by acting with this operator m times, you would get, you simply need to multiply it by z divided by square root 2 at each stage. Right, so you end up with a wave function which looks like that. z^(m) √(2)-m 2π m·. So in the end, the Hilbert space has very, very simple structure, right? So you see that m's orbital is simply this exponential multiplied by the z^(m). So arbitrary. So if I want to write arbitrary state in the 0th Landau level, I can take any superposition of these states, and you can see it's going to be simply arbitrary state is psi of z is simply f(z) - z^(4), where this f of z can be any analytic function, right? Any analytic function of z. So So in particular, it can be any polynomial which depends on the z. Okay, so now we understand the structure of the Hilbert space. So now let's solve the simplest interacting problem. Let's consider just two electrons and make them interact and see what would the structure of the two particle Hilbert space look like. And this is going to teach us a lot about what happens when you have a lot of electrons. So first, start with the two-body problem. So crucial step which makes the life easier is to separate the motion of the center of mass. Because you know that interactions only depend on the distance between the particles, but not on the what their center of mass is doing. So let us introduce new coordinates. So there will be a large z, so which is z1 plus z2 over 2, and there would be, this is center of mass. And little z, simply the relative position. Relative position. So, of course, the motion of the center of mass separates, because of that, I can introduce the analogs of my ladder operators now defined for this new coordinates z large and z small, right? So I can define ladder operator for the center of mass, which, as you can easily check, will be simply b1 dagger plus b2 dagger over square root 2. And b r dagger is the difference of the two. Then you can check that these operators obey all the same commutation relations, so they commute with each other, right? And they commute with their conjugates like the ladder operators of the harmonic oscillator. The only difference is that when you do such a transformation, you need to redefine the magnetic length. So effective magnetic length for the center of mass motion is square root 2, and effective magnetic length for the relative motion is square root 2 times L. Right. You can see it very simply if you start with two identical Hamiltonians for the two particles and then re-express them in terms of this new coordinates, right? So this tells us what is the structure of the Hilbert space as long as there are no interactions, right? So any state can be represented in the basis where this quantum number set by the operator B is M large for the center of mass motion and M small for the relative motion. And also important thing to realize that, of course, this number m, right, it has the meaning of the angular momentum, right? So you can show it explicitly, but intuitively it's very clear. So it's clear that you're in magnetic field, so the motion is chiral, and if m is small, you're making small orbits. If m gets larger, you're making larger orbits. right? As you can see from this wave function we derived here. Right, so this wave function, so let's actually go back to it for a second. Right, this wave function is centered far away from the origin for large M. Right, you can find it by simply finding the maximum of this density, right? So if you take a derivative, right, so the probability to find it at z equal r, you need to square it, right? So it's proportional to r to power 2m e to the minus r squared over 2. And if you just take the derivative and find the maximum, so take derivative, you'll get that it's 2m to m minus 1 e to the minus r squared 2. Or I can differentiate the exponential. And then I'll get, not surprisingly, r 2m plus 1 divided by 2, and again the same exponential. Right, so you see that the point r star where the probability to find the electron is maximum, which is obtained by putting this to 0, right, then gives you that r star squared is simply 4m, right? So this tells you that for the m's orbital is leaving distance roughly square root m away from the origin. Okay? So here by separating the motion of center of mass, we can view all states as some superposition of states with different, you know, fixed angular momentum of the center of mass and the relative angular momentum. So the Hamiltonian, this tells you that the Hamiltonian, which can be written, of course, in terms of the A operators, which are analogous to this B operator. So I will also define the A operators for the center of mass motion and for the relative motion. So then the kinetic energy can be simply written as so you find 1 plus A. So this is for the center of mass motion, and this one is for the relative motion. But for a second, let me stay within the zeros lambda level. Then, you know, this is zero, this is zero. I can forget about it. And then the only thing I need to worry about is the interactions, which of course do not care about the motion of center of mass at all. And I can write them as a simple sum over states with different relative angular momenta. Okay? So where here I just have the matrix element of the Coulomb interaction over this state with a given relative angular momentum. So I can also write it in a more compact way. So let me call this matrix element Vm. And now, of course, there are no, right, Coulomb interactions cannot take you between the states with different relative angular momentum because it's rotationally symmetric. So so M is always an eigenstate of this V, which actually makes things a lot easier, as you will see. Where this operator is effectively a projector onto a state with a given angular momentum M. Right? So this actually gives extremely convenient parametrization of the interaction Hamiltonian. So this tells us that all we need to know about the system is this set of numbers Vm, right, where m could run 1, 3, 5, and so on. Only odd ones because wave function must be anti-symmetric, right? So we are dealing with fermions, so they can only be in a state with an odd relative angular momentum. And this set is called Haldane pseudopotentials. Pseudopotentials. And they control all the physics of the partially filled Landau level. So depending on the values of these parameters, you can end up with many different phases with really different properties. So you can end up with fractional quantum Hall states. You can end up with states which are compressible and look more like a Fermi liquid and so on. Right? So it's extremely rich, and it's all determined by these parameters. So let's stop here. And so, and tomorrow we will see how to we will talk about Laughlin wave function and about the physical properties of the fractional quantum Hall states and their excitations. Okay, and this formulas will be very useful in seeing why the Laughlin wave function works. At least in some simplified model. So guys, if you have questions about this stuff, please ask now. Okay, no questions?
Just to have a general question. So are you aware of use of Laplacian type wave functions for systems in depth of magnetic field, or this works only those functions by construction are applicable only for the case of strong magnetic field?
So I think they really only work in the case of strong magnetic field. Mm-hmm. There are various ideas of, you know, getting fractional quantum Hall effect in a non-trivial band and depth in some magnetic field, but there of course you don't have rotational invariance. Uh-huh. Right? And then things are a lot more complicated because here I think what makes it really makes it work so well is the combination of magnetic field and rotational invariance, right, which gives the Hilbert space this very beautiful simple form. Mm-hmm. Right? If you are thinking about electrons on the lattice, this is all gone. Right? And I mean, in principle, you could consider various deformations of this wave function, right? But it's not easy, and people didn't really make any progress in that. And you can see why it's important already here, right? So you can see that if I release the requirement of the rotational invariance, right, then I can no longer get away with a simple parameterization. Then I need to worry about interaction changing the angular momentum. Right? So then I have a much larger space of space of parameters, right? And there are all sorts of transitions between the states with different angular momentum, so it becomes really messy and I mean, people looked at it a little bit, but didn't make much progress.